I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A few generations ago, college was largely for the well-connected and the well-to-do. A lot has changed over the decades, and now high schools are more focused on getting students into college to get those skills for a job that pays more than the minimum wage. One of the results of this shift is mounting college debt, which now totals something like $1.5 trillion. Our guest, Paul Tough, spent the last few years talking with students and their families for his new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. He found that the promise of higher education, leveling the playing field and providing mobility, has not panned out. Instead, he writes, colleges and universities too often exacerbate the divide between the top 20% of the population and first-generation students, low-income students, and students of color. He takes a critical look at the admissions process, the SAT and ACT, selective universities, the competition for dollars, and more. He also profiles inspiring students determined to surmount the hurdles and pressures of getting into college, and professors determined to ensure that their students thrive in their classrooms. Paul Tough joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Full confession here. I went to George Washington University. I dropped out for 2 years. I finished at Temple University. And those 2 years when I was not in school were the years that matter most. And I'm talking to someone who never graduated from college. So go ahead.
Yes, it's the dropout hour here.
It is the dropout hour.
So I also dropped out of college, not once but twice. First out of Columbia University. Then I went back and went to McGill in Montreal and then dropped out. I spent a lot of time as I was working on this book trying to figure out what my own personal story meant for the subject I was writing about. Most of my conclusion was it didn't mean a whole lot. I feel like there are people who want to tell this story that you don't need a college degree, that and anytime they find someone who doesn't have one and has had a career, then I feel like we're used as this example.
Right.
And the reality is it is very hard to have a profession as I have in journalism right now without a college degree. So it's given me sort of an empathy for the skepticism about college, because I didn't like college very much. But it has also made me, but I don't want to make too much of my dropout.
No, nor do I. But I think, certainly in my case, I have a kind of white privilege that really puts dropping out of college into a different category.
Absolutely, for me as well.
What was interesting to you, and you spent a lot of time talking with young people, some, in their last years of high school, trying to figure out how to get into the college of their choice. And these were, smart young kids from struggling neighborhoods, sometimes struggling schools. What did you learn from them?
I learned that they have placed a lot of emphasis, and this has put a lot of pressure on them, in which school they get into. And this was true actually for those low-income students I was talking to, but it was also true for the high-income ones. So I spent some time at an SAT tutor in suburban Washington, D.C., working with affluent kids. And what was striking was there was this intense pressure on both sides. And what you want to do as the adult in that situation is tell these young people, like, it doesn't matter where you go to college, it doesn't matter. And I did feel that on an individual basis, but at the same time, I was reading all of this economics research that said it does matter, and that we have created a system where more benefits go to the people who are able to go to the most selective institutions. And the problem with that is that most of those people come from affluent families. And so while on an individual level I wanted to calm them down, on a societal level, I felt like it was a real crisis.
Let me quote something. A young woman named Shannon, who you talked with, she wanted to go to Princeton and to the University of Pennsylvania. Those were her star schools. Mm-hmm. And she tells you, I've been working so hard for the past. How long have I been in school? I've been in school since I was three. So you take the thing that you've been the best at your entire life, and you have someone, or in this case, a group of people sitting in a circle who have not met you personally, who are determining if you are deserving. I mean, that is the process, largely, if you're sort of an unknown when it comes to a university.
Yeah, and so this is the opening scene in the book is I was sitting on a park bench with Shannon in West Harlem, just outside her high school on March the 30th of her senior year. She was waiting to get these results, and Penn was her dream school, and she was waiting to find out if she'd gotten in. And so what struck me was just how how sort of emotional it was for her.
And she was
again,
crying.
She was, yeah. And so there was this, I mean, there is this like real economic benefit to the colleges that she was trying to get into, but it also had become this kind of existential question for her. And I feel like for her, she was very focused on this American idea of social mobility. She might not have called it that, but this idea that she wanted to leave behind where she had come from, or the disadvantages that she had had in her youth, in her childhood, and aspire to something mm-hmm. bigger. And that is what higher education at its best does. It helps low-income students reach the middle-class kids reach affluence. It is this great engine of social mobility. But she felt like she was, and she was, I think, trapped in this system where all she could see were the obstacles to
sure.
that mobility.
Well, it should be said that she did not get into Princeton. She did not get into Penn. She did get into Stanford.
That's true.
Am I giving too much away here?
Well, I hope people will read the book and find out, get the.
But just to come,
just
want
so she
leave
but,
people hanging here.
Absolutely. But so she, that story, it was a crazy one, because it was like that day on the bench was not a happy one, and she did not get the results that she wanted. And yes, you're right, there is a change at the end. But what happened, I think, to her is that she went into that process and even into that day really believing that there was this meritocratic system. And she had her doubts, she had her fears, but she thought that if I do everything right, and she was absolutely doing everything right, she was the valedictorian of her school. She had been at the top of her class since the first day of freshman year. She hadn't missed a day of high school. If you do everything right, this system will work for you. And by the end, even though she did have a happy result, it made her feel like this system is really just kind of a game. It's just sort of this roll of the dice. And I think that's how a lot of students feel, and it's hard to argue against them.
On the other end of the scale, you mentioned an SAT or a tutor. His name was Ned Johnson, and you watched him work with charging $400 an hour, so you can imagine who his clientele are. But watching him work with these young students, also feeling anxiety, but at the upper end of the income scale.
Yeah, it was striking, sort of juxtaposing those two experiences. And Ned is, he's a great guy. He's a very good teacher. Has some really interesting ways of sort of combating the anxiety that his students feel. But it was, striking how he was able to help them raise their test scores by on the SAT by hundreds of points, and the ACT by 5 or 6 or 7 points, which just changes the opportunities that you have completely. And it was hard to think of the system as a real meritocracy, as something that was fair, once I'd spent some time in his office, because here were students who were paying lots of money and getting much better test scores and thus getting into much better institutions. So my sense was that the unfairness of the system was toxic, not only for Shannon sitting on that park bench in West Harlem, but also for the young people sitting in his office. I mean, they were definitely benefiting more. They were getting the benefits of the system, but I felt like it was eating away at them in some way as well.
Is that an argument to get rid of the SAT then, or the ACT?
Well, it's certainly an argument for colleges to put less emphasis on it, because it is more, I think, than GPA, something that is well, and certainly the evidence is that it correlates more with family income than GPA does. GPA really shows the kind of work you can do in school. It's the most predictive indicator of how well you're going to do in college, and that makes a lot of sense. SAT scores can be helpful. They can be predictive, but they also can change a lot with high-priced tutoring.
The College Board not happy with your book. They have some criticisms of it, and they say the book grossly misrepresents the College Board's work in addressing social problems, going on to say, as our own research shows, grades are slightly more predictive than SAT scores overall. Taken together, however, grades and SAT scores are much more predictive than either alone. I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but I think anyone that has muddled through the essay, my SAT scores were terrible.
Uh-huh.
Whether we invest too much in these numbers.
So it is easy to get in the weeds when you talk about the predictivity of these different things. But here's the argument that I found most persuasive. So there are a number of schools that have gone test optional, like half of the top 100 liberal arts colleges in the country are now test optional, meaning that you don't need to submit scores if you apply there. And what The argument that they make, the people who support test optional admissions make, is that, yes, that the College Board is right. Those two facts are sort of everyone agrees that grades are more predictive than test scores alone, but that if you add the two together, they're slightly better. It's a slightly better prediction. But these admissions folks who are in favor of test optional admissions, they don't argue with that fact, but they say the additional benefit that you get from looking at test scores is outweighed by the fact that those test scores correlate so strongly with income. So yes, I might have a slightly better predictor of who's going to do well in my school, but it means I'm going to have all this pressure to admit more rich kids and fewer poor kids. And what the best colleges that I wrote about found is that if you're admitting low-income students, even if they have slightly lower test scores, there are things you can do as a university to help them succeed. And so instead of putting your emphasis on what their test scores are, put your emphasis on helping those kids get through and graduate.
What would that be to help these kids graduate?
It's kind of common sense stuff. So I reported a lot at the University of Texas, which over the last few years, an administrator there named David Lottie undertook this project to increase their graduation rates, which were kind of low. And what he found was that, as at many schools, the graduation rates for the low-income, first-generation, and students of color were lower than more advantaged groups. And so he took this on as a five-year project. And he did a lot and introduced a lot of interesting programs, but they weren't that like high-tech and innovative. It was like, let's create communities where students feel a sense of belonging. Let's, you know, do smaller classrooms and extra tutoring. And they were internships where the students would work in different parts of the university. A lot of it had to do with the sort of psychological, emotional level of being a low-income student in a selective institution. You feel like an outsider, and so you're susceptible to messages that you can't keep up. And if you counteract those messages and say, no, absolutely you can, your first semester might be hard, but it's hard for everybody, those students are more likely to feel like, okay, fine, I'm struggling right now, but I can get over it.
We're almost up in a break here. You profile, I wish I'd had this professor when I was in college, Uri Trasman, who has such a bond with the students and such a belief that they'll be able to prevail in a pretty complicated course.
Yeah, so this is freshman calculus at the University of Texas, and as a college dropout, it was challenging for me to go through an entire freshman calculus class.
Yeah, you took the class, right?
I did, and I didn't, unfortunately, learn much calculus, but I did learn a lot about how teaching and running a university can work at its best. And so Uri is just a great teacher, but he is also a very aware of the psychological research about this idea of belonging, about what the kind of identity threat that low-income and first-generation students feel, especially in challenging first-year courses like freshman calculus. And so he didn't make his course any easier. In fact, he made it harder than the other sections, but he gave them messages along the way that they could succeed and they could belong at UT. And they did.
Let's take a short break. We'll pick up on that. That's Paul Tough, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book. It's called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. You can join us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Paul Tough about colleges and universities, the admission process, SATs, and much more. Let me quote something from Anthony Abraham Jack. You interviewed him for your book. He's got a piece in this weekend's Sunday edition of the New York Times, their education issue, as do you, Paul Tough. And he talks about, he's been a guest on Radio Times. He says, night came early in the chill of March. It was my freshman year at Amherst College, a small school of some 1,600 undergraduates in the hills of Western Massachusetts, and I was a kid on scholarship from Miami. I just survived my first winter, but spring seemed just as frigid. Amherst felt a little colder or perhaps just lonelier without money to return home for spring break like so many of my peers, which I think speaks to what you were talking about earlier about the sort of psychological, even cultural challenges that students of color or first-generation students face when going, especially to more elite universities.
Yeah, so Tony Jack, he was a great source, and his book, The Privileged Poor, is fascinating, partly because he's lived this experience of being a first-generation student, but also because he then, as a sociologist, interviewed hundreds of students at a highly selective institution and heard their stories. And I heard a lot of them, too, talked to some, and there was one student in particular, a woman named Kiki Gilbert.
Yeah, at Princeton.
Princeton, who I followed for a couple of years. And it's a complicated process because I find when I talk to these students, first-generation students at highly selective institutions, they are on one level really appreciative of what they have, grateful for this education that they're getting. They realize it's a lucky break, but they also feel very much like outsiders. And the actual day-to-day experience is kind of miserable sometimes. Partly that's just a process of social mobility. So anytime you're going through this process, important though it is, it's painful. You know, you're leaving behind your family and your culture and your history and struggling to get this new identity, figure out, are you the new person? Are you the old person? Are you something in between? But also the fact that these institutions have become such examples of concentrated wealth and privilege, it means if you're not a rich kid, you're surrounded by this wealth that makes you not only feel like an outsider, it makes you mad because you can see the inequities, the injustices in that system.
In fact, you say 3/4 of students from top 20% incomes are the ones that are largely selected by these universities. Or put another way, both Penn and Princeton, you write, 71 and 72% are the top quintile, the top 20% of the population. That's really from the very, 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 very rich to really the solidly upper middle class.
Yes, and then on the flip side, at those two schools that Shannon was applying to, the percentage of students who are from the bottom quintile, so the fifth of families with the least amount of income, it's only about 2 or 3% of those of the student body comes from that population. So if you're one of those students, there's just not a lot of people around who look like you and there or who had the kind of experience that you had, and there are a lot of students from that top quintile, and you may have never met anyone from that world. You don't understand their references. They don't maybe particularly feel all that welcoming to you. So it can be a really jarring experience.
I mean, there's so many subtle things, what people are wearing. I mean, whether what they do with their if they have, you know, money in their pocket, what they're buying, what they're getting for lunch. I mean, all these subtle things can make such a big difference.
Yeah, and I would say even more subtle is that, so I spent some time with Kiki, this Princeton student, in this amazing seminar, philosophy seminar that she was taking. And there was a difference in the way the students sat and talked that Kiki felt very competitive. She felt like she had to be perfectly on her game in order to impress people in this class. She felt like they were judging her for her race and her class. Whereas all the other more privileged students were just had this very kind of laid back, cracking jokes, making cultural references. And so it was amazing watching them. They're all very smart young people. But it was like they were on two different planets playing two different games. And they were all competing. They were all trying to prove that they were really smart. They were just doing it in these very different ways.
Do you think this is a class issue is maybe even more than a race issue?
It's hard to disentangle those two things. And Kiki, who's African-American and low income, spent a lot of time trying to disentangle those. And I think she found it confusing partly because so many of the African-American and black students at Princeton were not from low income families, were not the kind of black kids who she had grown up with. A lot of what she was wrestling with that first year was those intersections between race and class.
You write about the admissions industrial complex. I mean, this gets down to the decisions that colleges, universities make about who they are going to accept.
Yeah, so that phrase, which I love, is one that was coined by this admissions director I profiled named John Bockenstedt. And I spent the first part of my reporting talking mostly to students like Shannon and Kiki and Ned Johnson students in D.C. And when you're spending time with those students, you think of the admissions department as this all-powerful group of individuals. It's, you know, what Shannon was describing, these people sitting in a circle judging me, right? And then I started spending time with John Bockenstedt and a few other admissions directors, and I came to understand that they don't feel powerful at all. They feel like they are trapped in this system where all of the pressures of the institution are on them. partly just to make raise enough money to bring in enough tuition to keep the college afloat. And there are a lot of American colleges right now that are in real financial trouble. And what makes their job so difficult is not only do they have to do that, get in enough customers to pay the bills, they are also in a system where they can't publicly admit that that's what they're doing. That, you know, a couple of them shared this with me. But, you know, university presidents, they do not talk about admissions as something to bring in tuition revenue. They talk about it in terms of merit and diversity. We just, you know,
mobility.
Want, exactly. And so those two conflicting drives collide in the admissions office, and it puts a great deal of pressure on them to both to make the right decisions, but also to talk about those decisions in a certain way.
You also talk about the power of U.S. News and World Reports, America's Best Colleges, that is still, to this day, a very powerful publication.
Yeah, it's a very powerful force. And so there are some polls of people in admissions departments, what they think about it, and they do not like it. So there's sort of unanimity that it warps their decisions. It makes them value things that they don't necessarily value. It makes colleges spend more than they want to spend, because that's one of the criteria that U.S. News pays attention to. It also inclines them to pay attention to test scores, even when they would prefer not to, because mm-hmm. the higher your test scores, the more U.S. News likes you. So for a long time, I feel like the ways that U.S. News has measured what makes a college great, admissions people feel like it pushes them in directions that make it less possible for them to make the right decisions.
So is anyone happy with our system? You've got stressed out students and their parents. You've got admissions people who feel as if they're being pulled in a million different directions. Does this serve anybody?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, in certain ways, high-income students now have a great advantage in admissions. So in terms of just getting in where you want to get in, if you are from a wealthy family, the fact that colleges need to pay so much attention to whether you can pay your tuition, if you can pay the tuition, it is a lot easier to get in. But I feel like the inequities in the system, it's this sort of combination that I think we saw in the college admission scandal, that the combination of an unequal system where the stakes really are high, it makes everybody a little bit crazy. And some students, some parents, I think, go a little crazier than others.
Well, and that's, of course, the admissions scandal, and it's still ongoing. Parents accused of paying this consultant, a guy named William Singer, and there are others involved, bunch of money to cheat on standardized tests, to bribe coaches. I mean, what a brazen scheme. And it worked for some time. I mean, they were putting heads of students onto bodies of athletes.
Yes, the Photoshop application technique. It was crazy. And I mean, so I feel like at this point, this is the side of admissions that everybody sees. And in certain ways, it is obviously sort of the most exaggerated, the right. most crazy version. But what struck me, I spent some time reading through the FBI wiretaps between of these phone conversations between William Singer and these parents. And as I read them, what struck me was they didn't sound like they were in the middle of a criminal conspiracy, though they clearly were. They sounded like any other stressed out, affluent parents. It was like, oh, I can't believe we're doing this. Like, this is such a crazy system. Do we really need to do this? And I don't especially sympathize with these parents, but I can kind of empathize that when you are a parent in this sort of affluent community and you feel this intense competition, not only among your kids, but for yourself, you know, how you're judged next to these other parents, because you know the system is unfair, even though if you recognize that it's rigged for people like you.
Right.
You just feel like there are no rules, right? So anything I can do to get a leg up, I'm going to. And these parents clearly crossed an important line. But I feel like there are a lot of other parents who feel the same instinct.
But also this belief that if I can get my child into this elite university, that they will be set for life. I mean, I think it's this belief that the college is going to give you all the tools and experiences and context that you're going to need to be a rich person in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's crazy about the parents who were caught up part of that college admission scandal is that their kids are set for life anyway, right? So, you know, someone like Shannon, it really does matter. Where she goes to college is going to make this huge difference. For so many of these parents, I think it had just become I think it's what happens when we take a collective good, which is what public higher education used to be in this country, and turn it into a consumer good, right? And a scarce consumer good, because that is, that's how people get crazy about handbags and cars and everything else. If you feel like it's this important consumer good and there's not that much of it, certain parents are going to go crazy trying to get it.
The scarcity model, right?
Exactly.
So everyone's sort of in it for themselves.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Paul Tough, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book just out called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. And you can join us. I want to read some comments here. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This goes back to we were talking about earlier about the SAT, and Jen says, sounds like scrapping the SAT would solve a lot of problems. Do you agree with that?
I think it would solve some problems at some institutions. I mean, one of the things that struck me once I started spending time with these admissions directors, and this article in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday talks about this a little bit, is even when schools do go test optional, it is still very difficult for them to – very rare that they increase their population of low-income students a whole lot. So the SAT is one factor that makes it easier for them to admit high-income students and not low-income students. But they also have all these other pressures, the main one being just needing to bring in enough tuition revenue to support the college. And so I do think that more colleges should consider going test optional. It might not be right for every college, mm-hmm. but it might be right for some. But I also feel like it's not a silver bullet. It doesn't change everything.
You were talking about the University of Texas. They have a really interesting program or policy. They take the top 10 graduates from the high schools in Texas, correct?
Yeah. So it's called the top 10% rule. And originally it was if you were in the top 10% by class rank of your high school, you were automatically admitted to the University of Texas in Austin. So many students in Texas now want to go to UT that they've had to cut it back to 6%. So now you have to be in the top 6% of your school. But it is still true. It is two-thirds of the classes admitted automatically from all around Texas. And it what's fascinating about it is that it creates this interestingly diverse freshman class because the students who are in the top 6% at, affluent school in suburban Dallas, they're exactly like the kind of kids who are going to Ivy League schools and other highly selective institutions. They're mostly white, mostly wealthy, mostly with high SAT scores. But at the top 6% at a school in, a ranch community in West Texas or an inner city neighborhood in Houston or a Latino majority school in the Rio Grande Valley, they come from very different backgrounds. They're still excellent students, but they usually have less family income and lower SAT scores. So all these Texans come together on this campus, and in some ways there are a lot of differences between them. In some ways they have this important thing in common, right, that they are these great students. And what UT now does is tries to figure out what kind of different helps and supports it needs to give those students so they all can succeed.
And which you mentioned earlier, I mean, having internships and, creating this psychological environment where kids feel like they can succeed.
Yeah, and I mean, it's natural, right? When kids come from those different backgrounds that they're going to feel that diversity, that difference. But it doesn't take too much to make them feel like a community. And I think that is the important part of what UT does. It does take some effort. I think a lot of colleges have for a long time had this sink or swim mentality where we don't want to baby these kids. Like if they can't hack it in college, they weren't meant to be here. Our job is to winnow out the chaff from the wheat. But more and more colleges are saying, actually, we should probably pay attention to whether our students succeed. And once you make that decision, it takes some effort, but it's not impossible.
An email from Cindy. She says, I'm the proud parent of a college student athlete who is now a senior. He was accepted based on merit. This college cheating scandal is typical of the wealthy paying to get their children ahead. Even if they have not earned it, they should be made examples to show that this dishonesty will no longer be tolerated. And I mean, there's some question about just, how much time they might spend in prison, for mm-hmm. instance.
Yeah. And I agree with her in all sorts of ways. My only worry about the way that we are experiencing that scandal is that I think there's an urge, especially among upper middle class and affluent parents, of saying like, well, that's them. They're breaking the law. They're different. The system, for me, my kids are getting it on merit. It's not the same for my kids. And the reality is there are all kinds of unfairnesses and inequities in the system, things like early admissions, the way that colleges recruit athletes, SAT scores, you know, simply like the cost of tuition. There are all of these systemic inherent advantages if you have some money in this system. And so it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, be proud of your kids and can't help them get to the best institution they can. But I feel like it is really important for those of us who have advantages in the system to recognize them. And I think that's part of what happened to those parents who did break the law, that they couldn't accept the idea that they were benefiting already.
Here's an email from Tom. He says, I was not college material when I graduated from high school. I went to my community college, which had open enrollment. Three degrees later, I now teach at that college. There is another way. And you know, there is this, I guess, belief that you get on this track and you don't deviate. And you don't, as Tom was describing, you know, I probably wasn't ready for that more
high-functioning,
you know, right. Elite college experience.
So, I mean, Tom's experience, I feel like, is that it should be the experience that lots of students have. My impression is that it is very rare for young people today to be able to achieve the kind of success that Tom did starting at community college. But it's exactly what community college is for, right?
Exactly.
So many students come out of high school not quite sure what they're doing, and then often they're paying, you know, or their families are paying a tons of money for them to figure it out, and they often make a lot of wrong turns, like, you know, you did and I did, or right turns as it happened. But you know, that's normal, right, when you're 18 and 19. And so community college, I think, is the perfect place to go because it is cheap, and it should be cheap, or, you know, ideally free. And it's a place where you can either learn a trade, get the kind of initial credits and basic knowledge that you need in order to transfer to a four-year institution. It's a great idea. However, we have been cutting the budgets of community colleges across the country. In public higher education as a whole, we've cut the public funding by 16% per student just since 2000. And that has really kneecapped those institutions. They just don't have the resources that they did before, and so they are not able to play that role as well as they used to.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Paul Tough, again, our guest on Radio Times today. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, How Children Succeed. He's got a new one, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. We posted something on our Facebook page that he wrote that actually will be published this weekend in the New York Times Magazine, their education issue. 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Paul Tough about his new book, The Years That Matter Most. I should add, he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. There's so many young people that you profile in this book, but there's a family. There's Trevor, there is Kim, and then there is Ori. Tell us about this family.
Yeah, so this is a family in a little town called Taylorsville in the western sort of Appalachian foothills of North Carolina. And I met them originally through Kim. So she was this high-achieving student at her mostly low-income rural high school in North Carolina. And she had aspirations to go to a highly selective college. And so I spent some time following her and trying to figure out what it was like to be a low-income white kid in a rural community. Trying to figure out whether you should leave home, whether you should leave your family and your culture. But the more I got to know her and talk to her, the more I realized, as what happened with a lot of the students that I followed, that so much of her feelings about college were mixed up with her feelings about her family. Yeah. And her family's feelings about college. And her family was very skeptical about the value of higher education for her and in general. And part of the reason was that her older brother, Trevor, had been the first in his family to go off to college. So, you know, in some ways,
AP
he was like
courses. I
yeah,
mean, a smart
he was
kid,
one of
obviously.
Those sort of Tony Jack stories of like going off, and it was a complete disaster. So he didn't feel prepared. He didn't feel at home. He you know, as a first generation student, he just was very confused and didn't have at the college he was going to that the stuff that they've got at UT to those outreaches, those interventions to make him feel at home, make him feel like he could succeed. And so dropped out, spent a couple of years hitchhiking around, is in debt still. So to his family, he had become this cautionary tale. And that Kim felt this pressure on her that no one believed in her because they believed that it hadn't worked for him.
But she did prevail. She went to Clemson, right?
Yeah, she ends up at Clemson. She's still there. I think she's starting her senior year. Yeah, she's an amazing student, and she did, but she felt like she had to do that without her family.
Well, and I think she's an example of where it's just we make things so hard for these aspiring students, especially ones without the kind of advantages that other children have.
Yeah, there was this moment right before the beginning of her senior year where she suddenly came to understand that she hadn't been able to raise enough money for tuition. There was this Parent Plus loan she was trying to get. Her mom's credit rating wasn't good enough, and no one else in her family would co-sign for it. And meanwhile, she's talking to Clemson's financial aid department, and they're saying, why haven't you figured this out before? And it was such, there was just such pressure on her. It was just this sort of miserable time when all of the institutions in her life, both her family and her college, were just telling her what she'd done wrong. And in fact, she had spent, you know, 4 years doing everything right in order to get to that point. And so she sort of collapses and spends a couple of weeks on the couch watching reruns.
I forget what show that was. But
Grey's Anatomy.
There
right?
you go, so Grey's
seven
Anatomy.
Seven seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
Right, without essentially moving from the couch.
Exactly. But then, you know, as a lot of these, not a lot, but not all of them, of these young people do, she got up. She was like, this is not what I want. What I want is to go to Clemson. And she figured it out for herself. And she's there now, and she's going to graduate. But she is an example of, for me, of all the obstacles that we put in the path that let that, you know, holding up her as a success story, which she is in many ways, the problem with doing that is it's saying like, yeah, the kids who should succeed are the ones who can make it through this horrible obstacle course that we set for them. We don't need to make it that difficult.
Now tell us about Ori, also part of this family.
Yes. So her, the third sibling, Ori, when I was spending time with her and her family, he had just started a welding program at the local community college, Catawba Valley Community College. And he was not a great student in high school. He's not a particular fan of school at all. But like a lot of young people in that situation, after after high school, he'd started working. And he'd found that in the economy we have today, if the only credential you have is a high school diploma, it is very difficult to find stable, decent paying work. You know, he like was able to get above minimum wage pretty quickly, but all of his jobs, the hours were terrible. He was always, you know, there was no job security. It is this very unstable labor economy that we have for people with those credentials. And so he decided in his early 20s that he wanted to go back to school and get a welding degree. And so what the reason that – I mean, he was a fascinating guy, and it was interesting watching him progress towards that degree. But one of the reasons I was drawn to his story was this was this moment that maybe we're still in where welding in certain sort of political and media circles had become this kind of meme, this kind of idea that there is an alternative to higher education, to college, and it's welding, that you can make a ton of money and not have to go to college to be a welder. There was this article in the Wall Street Journal that said that welders are making $150,000 a year, and that got picked up by politicians like Marco Rubio and others. And what Ori found as I watched him after a couple of years of struggling towards this degree was that there were two things wrong with this meme. One was that the idea of welding as an alternative to college was undercut by the fact that you have to go to college
in order to become a welder.
Right. It was like welding's really hard and it's really complicated. It was a 2-year degree, a lot of courses he had to pass. And then the other problem was that you don't make $150,000 as a welder. It's a great job in many ways, but the average salary is just a little over $40,000. So, and you know, this is mostly like, you know, men in their 40s and 50s supporting families. So, what I felt like was Ori had been disadvantaged by all the things that Kim and Trevor were, but he had also been disadvantaged by this political idea that had promised him something that the system wasn't really ready to deliver.
Hank says, I became a radio engineer through 3 years of trade school. Are technical schools and training programs a sufficient alternative to elite colleges? I mean, picking up on what we were just talking about. I mean, not everyone should go to college, but we want to make sure that people who graduate from high school, first of all, have the education and the skills that they need, but that they can make a living and support themselves and raise a family if they want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I feel like that is college, right? So the schools that are teaching things like radio engineering are there's two ways that they go. One is community colleges. The other is usually for-profit schools. And there's a big difference between those two options. And I think to a lot of students coming out of high school, the difference between those is not apparent.
Right.
And because community colleges don't have much money, they're not as good as advertising and marketing as those for-profit colleges are. But those for-profit colleges often have very low outcomes, very low graduation rates, very high debt. That's where a lot of student debt is coming from, those for-profit programs. And the reason that students are drawn to that is because we've cut back on our community colleges. But absolutely, there should be community colleges everywhere that have great degrees in radio engineering and welding and lots of other skilled trades. But to me, that is college. You know, that everyone doesn't need, not everyone has to go to college, and instead you can do this.
You need something post high school, right?
Right, and that to my mind, we should expand our definition of what college is. And the community college is college the same way that Clemson is, the same way that Princeton is. We need to have opportunities and funding for all of those different colleges, so that students have a real choice of genuine opportunities ahead of them.
Andrea asked, so what do you think about a public option or college for all, real public education? And this, of course, is coming from Elizabeth Warren, a number of the other Democrats running for president who believe in Bernie Sanders as well. Free college, get rid of college debt, you know, unburden these graduates.
Yeah, so I think there are some very good impulses in a lot of those ideas. I mean, some of the specific programs, I feel like what's wrong with getting rid of all college debt is that college debt is not right now evenly distributed. Most of the college debt is held by well-off people with college degrees, right? So it's a sort of an individual problem for some families. But wiping out college debt would actually give more advantages to the advantaged. What I like about this conversation is that it is reminding us of this premise that our collective public higher education benefits all of us, and we should invest much more money in it than we do. I just want to make sure that we're investing the money not just in making it free, but also making it good, and that we're investing that money in ways that make it more equitable rather than less.
Let me get a caller in on the conversation. We have Regina, and Regina is calling us from Princeton. Regina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things. So can you flesh out a little bit when you started off, you said that privilege, white privilege, makes dropping out unique, and you said that for you and your host. So if you can talk a little bit about that. And then the second thing is that I did research in my dissertation on space, particularly spaces that black people are not supposed to occupy, and that's the space of education. And so the intent is not to make these people feel welcome. So I'll take the response off the air, but if you could just kind of talk
sure,
about
no,
it a
I appreciate
bit.
It. Thanks, Regina. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, I'm the one that talked about my white privilege, and I know that I have it. I've lived many decades on this planet to know that I have a certain privilege that people of color do not have, and I'll just put it out there and stand behind that. But this idea of sort of these, you know, of spaces sort of reserved for certain people, whether that's implicit or explicit.
Yeah, I mean, I think both halves of Regina's question, I think, fit together perfectly. And so when I think about my own dropout and why I was able to do it, I feel like, you know, there are some specifics of that moment. It was three decades ago, the profession I was going into, journalism. But I think it also had to do with being a white guy from Canada, that it was easier for me to have people say, oh, he's probably okay without a degree, than I think it would be for a student of color.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think that would be true today. But what Regina is saying about the welcoming of academic spaces, I mean, it resonates with me because she's in Princeton, and the student who I followed most closely, Kiki Gilbert, is an African American student at Princeton University today, and that is so much of what I experienced with her or heard her experience as we talked through her freshman and sophomore years at Princeton, that there were all these ways that I think being a first-generation student, being a low-income student at a highly selective institution is challenging. And Tony Jack writes about a lot of them. Mm. But race is a critical one as well. And it was what Kiki spent so much time experiencing, the ways that she felt excluded and discriminated against because of her race.
I mean, she even described being in a classroom and people not sitting next to her. I mean, these are subtle but also such powerful experiences.
Yeah, and I think when you are that much of a minority, and for her, both in terms of race and class, she felt like she was taking this amazing course called the Humanities Sequence at Princeton, and she loved it. She loved reading all these philosophers, but she, her mind, that especially that first class, was so preoccupied by the idea that she was different from everyone else there, and she felt like they were judging her, and they were judging her poorly because of who she was and what her background was and what she looked like.
What do you think of legacy admissions?
I think it's one more advantage that that well-off students have. And I think, I mean, I feel like all of these different advantages add up. So legacy admissions, you have a leg up if your parents went to a highly selective institution. You know, I understand why these institutions do that. It connects with how they bring in a lot of money, which is through alumni donations. But there's no question that it's not fair, right? These students don't actually have any more merit. They don't have any more ability than students that they are being chosen instead of. And again, I feel like what is so frustrating about those institutions is that at the same time that they are following all these practices that give high-income students an advantage, the way they talk about their admissions is all about merit, all about diversity. Right. And the reality is very different.
You don't spend a lot of time on Jared Kushner, but you do spend a couple of paragraphs on the fact that his dad donated, I think it's $2.5 million to Harvard University. Jared was just beginning his senior year at the Frisch School. That's a private school in New Jersey. Now he got into Harvard. Is it because his dad gave Harvard $2.5 million? Can we prove that? Yes, no?
We cannot. Yes, no. You can never prove these things, right? I mean, so the William Singer, the college counselor who is now going to jail for a long time for his part in the admission scandal, the way he would describe it to his parents was that there's the front door that the suckers do, you know, where they actually do their applications and try and get in on their merit. There's the back door, which was the Kushner door, which is you give a lot of money to an institution and they're likely to let you in. And then he said, I'm going to create the side door, right? And one of the things that he said is the back door is not guaranteed. You can give $3 million to this institution and they can't guarantee that they will let your kid in. I think they
it's
often
hard to
do.
Imagine them.
Exactly. But they, you know, but there not. there is sort of this propriety to the system where you take the check with one hand and then you say, oh, I'll talk to the admissions department with the other. And so it was interesting to me that the parents he was making his pitch to were like, oh, yeah, this is a better guarantee of getting in, cheating, breaking the law, than even making these ridiculously huge donations.
Our colleges and universities, they're, you know, scattered across the country. We've got private universities and colleges. You've got public ones. You've got community colleges. Do you see any sort of collective effort to figure out how to address some of these problems that you have described? Or is it everybody for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is part of why I think it's a hard system to reform, that there are all – it is such an autonomous and diverse system. So I think two things. I mean, one is I do think that there are ideas change and minds change in slow and gradual ways. And there really is this shift, I think, on a lot of campuses toward being more honest and paying more attention to how admissions work. And then also, you know, going past this sink or swim mentality into actually helping students succeed. But I do think we need to have a bigger national conversation about how we want to change things. And so it is the thing that the reason that I feel heartened by the conversations that are going on in the Democratic primary. Again, I don't think the particular proposals are quite right yet. But the fact that we're now talking about opportunity and college and what role the federal government should play, that to me is a conversation that we used to have in this country and we haven't had for a while. And I hope it leads to better things.
Well, thank you for this conversation, Paul Tough. Thanks for coming in on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. And Paul Tough, our guest, wrote a book again a couple of years ago called How Children Succeed. And he's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, also a regular contributor to This American Life. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.